Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm very happy to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM two academics from the Faculty of Education here at the University, and they happen to be a couple, Dr. Duncan Paul Mercier and his wife, Dr. Daniela Mercier. Just a few words about my guests. Dr. Duncan Mercier is a senior lecturer of Philosophy of Education in the Department of Education Studies here, Faculty of Education. He studied at the University of Malta, the University of Sheffield, UK, and Stirling University in Scotland. His current interests are the concepts of becoming in educational contexts, the processes of writing and reading, continental philosophy in education, issues of diversity and otherness, issues of inclusion and disability, children's literature and philosophy, and issues focusing on the body. Before joining the Faculty of Education, he had experience teaching in primary, secondary, post-secondary and special education settings. He was head of Department of Education Studies for 3 years and is currently Deputy Dean of the Faculty of Education. A glance at his list of publication indicates that his research draws upon French post-structuralist philosophers to think through educational issues, and hopefully we'll also talk about that. Dr. Daniela Mercier is a practicing educational psychologist and senior lecturer within the Department of Education Studies at the University of Malta. Her research interest is in problematizing the assumptions which underpin educational practice with children and deconstructing situations in which decisions are made concerning children's well-being in schools, which sounds a bit complicated, but I'm sure that Daniela will be explaining exactly what that means as we go along during the program. So perhaps we should start off with the same question for you both, really. Perhaps you could both describe the approaches that you take within that educational milieu, just so that the listeners get an idea where you're coming from.
I studied philosophy here at university, and then I moved into education. So I try to marry the philosophy bit into the education and try to find a link between both. Then at one moment in my life, I went into disability studies. So it was philosophy, education, and disability and inclusive issues. And that's where I try to do most of my work. What I try to do is question a number of assumptions that are taken for granted within education contexts. We use terms, for example, child-centered education, inclusivity, and very often we just talk about them, use them, without trying to think what they might mean and how they are used and the power that people have in using these particular concepts. So that's what I try to do. I try to very often take education situations, what, you know, I encounter in school or through my research or through data we collect, and try and question what's actually happening there. It tries to give that moment of reflection that very often is in education quite a fast moving kind of world, where you need to stop for a minute and say, now, so what? So what's happening here? Can it be different?
Sometimes things are done and considered the norm, and they become embedded,
yes,
and unquestioned, as you say.
Very often. And education now has taken very much a managerial kind of approach. So everything is boiled down to doing things. So we need some spaces to reflect and think of what are we doing and if this is doing is working, especially for our children.
Daniela, you've come from a slightly different background.
Yes, well, originally I started my education here in psychology. but we have come to a meeting of our ways. And in fact, Duncan draws a lot upon psychology, also for narratives with which to think philosophically. And I draw upon philosophy to help me think about my practice and my teaching as well. To add a little bit regarding where we position ourselves, where I position myself within the educational milieu, it's about thinking again. That again is very important, because there was thought originally, but we are saying let's revisit, let's think again about things which we think are laid to rest. So my pet research would be about taking procedures which originally were planned to support children in schools. Suddenly these procedures, as part of a system, are larger than children, and now children have to fit within them. Originally they were made so that children would be helped, supported, they had to belong more in schools. Unfortunately, many situations end up being situations where children are categorized and sometimes marginalized. And that's a cause of concern for me. It's something which I meet in practice as a psychologist. I meet it in schools sometimes when I do my teaching practice visits, for example. But the idea is very much to let's resensitize ourselves to these situations.
I think that in many situations, not simply in an educational area or field, we often talk about reforms, and you sit back and you think, gosh, but why do we always need to be reforming? Wasn't it good enough before? Especially in politics, you'd hear a lot about reform and reform. But really, from what you're saying, it's obvious that reform is just ongoing.
Yes.
Or it should be ongoing. But sometimes we are caught up in doing things and forgetting what we wanted to do in the original place. And also, we have to acknowledge that education in Malta in the last few years, I'm saying 5 years, the context has changed so much that what we could do with particulars in a particular situation may not be
feasible,
valid for the students, or not being just towards particular groups of students. So we need to constantly also see where, you know, what we're doing and how the context is helping us or influencing us.
And how what we are doing is reflected in the principles. Because very often it's becoming a performative scenario where you need to be seen as doing. Otherwise, we're not valid. And sometimes the doing takes the place of the being. Let's talk about it in this way. We've had research done, even some of our students have worked on being with children, which is a lovely thing. And it's, again, a chance to rethink what it is that you are actually doing.
Yes, the listening process, I suppose, as well.
Part of it. And this impinges on a lot of aspects of work. I mean, very basically, it is also the dichotomy, as some people put it, but we do not agree with it, between the person and the professional. We strongly believe that you are very personal when you are a good professional, which may be a little bit unconventional as a thought, but I have had experiences where, for example, people console me about a situation which is sad. You know, say, this is, you need to be a professional, don't be upset about something. Whereas I believe that being upset about something makes me a better professional, because I would not settle for less, you know, and I would keep on trying my best to fix a situation which is unjust, for example.
I looked through your publications, obviously, in preparation for this chat of ours, and one of them, engaging with student teachers on reflective writing and reclaiming writing. Mm. And it intrigued me. And I wanted to ask you what you meant in that context by reflective writing and the need to reclaim writing.
With student teachers, but in most professions, I mean, very closely, for example, also in nursing or social work, people who work with others, and particularly in our situation with children, we ask them to reflect on what they're doing. So you do something, you do a lesson, you deliver a lesson, and then you just spend some time saying, okay, how was this lesson? What could be done better next time, you know, how did the children react to this? So there's a process of actually questioning what you have done. Now, unfortunately, what I think very often happens is that this has become a process that is being asked from our part to student teachers to do it, and becomes a mechanical thing. And when you see, you read lessons and the reflections, I started getting that feeling that there's no more, not so much soul in this. They do it because they're asked to do it. But you know that I have also another small research which is not published, where they even copy each other's reflections sometimes. So you do one, you do another, and then we just change a little bit. It's not yet published, but hopefully it will come out soon. So is this the reflective process or an inquiry process that we want students to take up? And that's why I said, okay, they are writing, but it's not. We need to find the writing which reclaims. And obviously I go to my philosophy background, as you've mentioned at the beginning. I go to Derrida, which helps me to think about the issue of writing. So we need to find a writing which allows for openness. So very often when we go for inquiry, we give them questions and they follow the questions. Could we think of different, for example, ask them to come up with a story, ask them to come up with an imaginative story, a dialogue, rather than them, you know, I've done this and this has happened like this because of this. Also, when it comes to inquiry, I fear sometimes that there is a big assumption that I can think on my own. Now I'm a bit frightened of this, because I think about a lesson. The following day I think about another lesson. If you're teaching a secondary school, sometimes you repeat the same lesson for 3 or 4 or 5 times a day, or a week, in a week. So how am I going to inquire, reflect? And that frightens me, that it becomes a repetitive kind of doing without any meaning. So this is what I try to do even with my student teachers. Try to find something which astonishes your thinking. It could be a video. I mean, one of the very powerful videos you can watch is Precious, for example, or teachers. But, you know, you see these videos and they shock you. Or read a book, or read Yui, or Derrida, you know, but they give you something which you haven't thought before. I mean, for me, I was doing a lecture yesterday on issues of power in the classroom, and I obviously was using Foucault to help me unpack some of the issues. And I was trying to help my students understand and together understand that they have power over children, but they are under the power of someone. So, in a lesson, where does power lie? Who owns power? So, all of a sudden, you have this idea, and it helps you to question what you're doing with that small idea which you get. Then, hopefully, that inquiry makes you a better professional, a better teacher, a better human being.
Yes.
So that was the idea behind this chapter.
Yes, the question of empowerment obviously is a huge question.
Yeah, because the assumption there is I'm still giving you power, though I'm still holding all this power and giving you. So I'm going to try and give you power, but still hold it, you know, and so that becomes a very interesting game.
Yes, not a very nice game.
Not a nice game, no.
Another subject that you've approached is early intervention, and I wasn't quite sure how to interpret what early intervention really means or meant in the context in which it was being written, and we discussed a little bit before coming on air about it. It sounded very interesting. Perhaps you could sort of expand.
Yes, in the current scenario educationally, that people feel and systems feel as though it is our duty not to diminish children's rights in any way, to make sure that we know how children stand, so as early as possible we know if there are any difficulties, so that support can be presented as early as possible. And there are arguments which, you know, which we like about this, because we do not want children to start floundering and then become disheartened and discouraged and so forth. However, then there are extremes to this, where people, for example, I know that currently they are screening kindergarten children for certain conditions. And in my experience as a psychologist, I've learned to be very wary of fixing a label on children so early that then it cannot be removed. When you actually pronounce a diagnosis or a condition, then it's very difficult to take back. When you hold off, in fact, my research is all about uncertainty. When you embrace the uncertainty, you say, you know, let's give it some time. Let's make sure that the support is there, but not necessarily accompanied by a label. Let's make sure that they are helped, that the parents are helped. We have difficulties with parents nowadays having smaller families and perhaps not knowing how to substitute the large number of siblings that children used to have. So children are very often not spoken to so much, not played with as much as they used to be before. So children may be silent, for example, at a very early age and does not develop speech so easily. Unfortunately, if we look for conditions, we very often find them. And my concern is that we do not start categorizing children and then risk losing children. Because when you do that, then you start marginalizing them.
It's a conundrum, really, isn't it?
It is, because you don't want to miss out on children with difficulties. I mean, I find it difficult to practice a lot at the moment because I have little children of my own. We do. But when somebody calls with a very young child, 2 years old, even less, or 3 years old, I find it hard to say no. So I do go and I go home and we talk about, you know, what's happening. And I feel it needs so much tentativeness. If me and the parents especially can tolerate being in this no man's land for a while, you know, we don't know exactly what's happening, but let's give it some time. Let's make sure whatever is necessary is in place.
Without making a thing of it.
Yes. However, systems do not help us. Mm-hmm. For example, at the moment, the boards that relegate resources and support and funding for NGO work with children require a diagnosis. So I have had parents come back to me saying, look, if you write this word, this diagnosis in a report, I will be given this kind of support. And that is completely against my principles. In fact, I only had to do it once because if the parents, I mean, a child would fit comfortably in a category, but he might not necessarily need to be there. We've had children who we refrained from labeling and they don't fit that label anymore.
The label disappeared.
It did. But when we do so, you know, at age 2 and 3, then it's difficult to have it disappear. And then if children start getting special treatment, you start seeing them through that lens, you know? So early intervention is a very good thing in its way. But I always want to be very cautious when talking about young children, even when talking about children who are not young, but particularly those who are young.
I've seen you nodding in agreement.
And one of the big things in early intervention is when it stops. So if you have 3 or 4 people supporting a child, and then at age 5, 6 it stops, then it goes all back. So sometimes it's important to support, but also to ex support over a long period of time rather than all together. So there are different kinds of interventions going on. Also, it's a particular kind of intervention. They become formalized interventions. So it's this what's being offered. So all children would have to fit into that kind of intervention. So it becomes quite, you know, difficult for some parents and children.
Yes, I can think of a child of a friend of mine who didn't speak very much or really hardly at all until 2 gone 2, and they were obviously very worried about it. If you listen to him now, it's a few years later, it sounds as though he's been to university. So. What about the idea of getting parents involved in literature? Because I know this is something that perhaps has gone a bit out of the window with technology coming in. And I enjoyed very much being involved with literature development of my own children. But I can understand that perhaps it's not as easy now, and not everybody has those resources either.
Yes, and time and energy, because it is a fast life that we lead, it's true. Very interestingly, until recently, about a month ago, the United States Pediatrics Association said that children under 2 years of age should not be exposed to screen time at all. And I really use that, you know, when I give a lot of talks to parents, and I said that. I also said, however, look, I am myself. My youngest is a year and 9 months old. So I do find myself saying, you can watch this while I'm peeling potatoes or whatever it is. I do say that to parents because I do not want them to feel that they are bad parents when they do this. Recently, however, in the past month or so, the pediatricians, they changed their statement to say that it is unreasonable to expect parents not to show any screen time at all to children under 2 years of age. And I thought it was very interesting the way they put it. It is unreasonable, but it's still desirable, isn't it? So I have kept my statement. I do say that, although, you know, it's fine if using technology is an activity that parents participate in themselves rather than use it as a babysitter, we can also explore other ways how children can help around the house. I mean, my youngest helps me put a load in the washing machine, and he wants to be involved in everything. But it's also because he knows I enjoy that he's involved in everything. It has happened to us that we say, let's switch on TV and we'll just finish this bit and then we'll switch it off. And a morning passes and the TV is still on. Because if you don't watch yourself, it will happen.
It also depends on quality of what they're watching as well, because there's a lot out there.
There is a lot, but 3 hours of it may still be too much.
Right. Right,
and it's very important then, that to go back to your question, that parents are involved in stories. Now, whether stories are coming from books or audiobooks or films, it depends on the kind of family you are, and ideally there is a balance, isn't it? Because we can't expect all children to access all stories through books, because that is sometimes difficult for families to do, for some families to do, especially if children have difficulties with reading. And something like that would deny children of a lot of culture, mm-hmm. which is important that they have, notwithstanding the fact that they find difficulties with reading.
We're talking about parents and literature and literacy, but I'd like also to add even culture. Let me give an example. For example, the Manuel Theatre, they organize every month Toy Toy, and we're big fans of Toy Toy, obviously.
You probably met my grandchildren then.
Okay. It's exposing children to, this week it's the Gozaik week. I mean, it was fantastic on Tuesday to see the Manuel Theatre packed, listening to our National Youth Orchestra. It was full of families and children. As you're saying, not all children have that opportunity. So we have to be careful that, and that's very often where schools try to compensate or support. But even there, sometimes we're going to an extreme. We have schools offering breakfast clubs and club 3 to 16. We have children from 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 or 6 in schools now. It's more than 40 hours a week. So we have to find balances in schools. That's why with our student teachers, we tell them, expose yourself to children's literature. If you don't know it, then how are you going to give it to students? I mean, this summer we discovered David Williams.
Yes, the comedian.
The mm-hmm. British.
He writes children's
British stories.
He's a judge on Britain's Got Talent.
Yes, I thought
Little
the
Britain,
name was...
But he's on Little Britain.
He's the actor on Little Britain.
But, you know, we are in children's literature. I teach about children's literature. We're parents, so we're constantly, you know, getting more and more. But you discover a new person. You discover a new way of reading. And it's, you know, it's fun to read, get his books, read them and share them. And So it's this, even schools providing books and culture. All schools in Malta, I assume all schools now have interactive whiteboards. During break, put on a piece of music, put on a, you know, a slideshow of art, painting, sculpture. Don't show them Mr. Bean, you know, because that's what they get from television at home. So let's try and offer our children something alternative to schools. But what I think Daniela said also is very important, is not to make parents feel guilty when they cannot offer that. Because sometimes a lot of us blame parents. And I think that needs to be retaught, that, you know.
Quite so. We have about 45 seconds left, and I have a quick last question, which I really wouldn't like to leave out. And it's this idea of interdisciplinarity within the education context. In my days, it was all teacher, class, and that was it.
Yes.
Now, what's happening?
Well, we've gone a little bit to the other extreme, I'm afraid, and we've got teachers who feel that they cannot deal with difficulties that children come up with. So we've got a lot of specializations, which are good in their way. However, I do like the idea that the teacher feels that she owns her children. Okay, I wouldn't like, when I was a teacher, I wouldn't have liked it if one of the children in my class had an emotional difficulty and then it had to be the PSD teacher who had to take care of it, or I know I wanted to be present in my children's lives. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there are different specializations which are very important in the kind of contribution that they make. Ideally, the teacher finds them as supportive mm-hmm. of her practice, not as
an imposition.
Only taking children mm-hmm. and fixing them and then yeah. bringing them back
we
to
cannot,
her.
You cannot allow for exclusion within inclusive settings, which sometimes happens. You know, you just take them out, move them out from the class, rather than to keep them together.
That's a subject we didn't go into. Yeah. Inclusivity will have to be the subject of another program, I'm afraid. Yes. Thank you both very much, Dr. Duncan Paul Merchia and Dr. Daniela Merchia, for coming to talk to us on University Matters
Thank you.
Today. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.